Two. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Fan Friction. We are live here on YouTube. Hello, everyone. Today we have three new panelists, including a mystery fighter, who is going to battle for fan supremacy in movie fights. We base our show off the Screen Junkies movie fights. We are called Fan Friction. If you've never seen the show before, there are five rounds of debate. I held up four fingers. Five rounds of debate. Oh, hang on one second, because my show just went live and I heard myself. There we go. We debate for five rounds, and then the people with the two most points go on to the lightning round, and they will base for three or five. The winner of the three or five is the winner of Fan Friction for today. So let me introduce our guests. Our first guest this week is bringing the sexy back to nerddom completely ironically. And maybe this time we'll actually see his face, because last time his camera cut out for pretty much the whole fight. Welcome back to our show, Langley M. Neely. Welcome,
thank
Langley.
You, thank you. Have to you, thank
you. There he is. Good to see you. You can find our second fighter on ScreenJunkies.com every single day, keeping you informed on all goings-on in the entertainment universe. She's a geek culture expert from my hometown of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Please welcome to the sarcastically wonderful Amy Awesome.
Hi, guys. Woo! How is everyone today?
Welcome. We're doing great. All right, everybody. You've waited all week to find out who the mystery panelist is, and it's time right now. Our third panelist is the host of Fan Friction on the Tough Channel and is the oldest nerd we could find to fight on the show. Normally, he hands out the points, but today he's going to have to earn them. Please put your hands together for the champ. This host, me, I'm going to be fighting today, everybody. Fan Friction time.
What?
Okay, they all knew. But that means the Fan Friction champion and host of the DVD Bunker here on Tough, Brian Hurst, will be taking over the judging duty for today's fight. Good luck, Brian. And guess what? The show's all yours, man.
Wow, thanks a lot, Jack. That's a pretty good intro. It seems like we've been doing this a little while. But the intro officially taking over the asylum, so expect all that professionalism to go out the window. I'm going to have my good friends here in the pair in the chair, our checker, fact checker extraordinaire. We're going to have the OSP host, Tom and Kimber, join us, doing the fact check and checking the Twitter for me, and hopefully keeping me on track, letting me not get too rambly, and help me remember all the things I've already forgotten. This is nerve-wracking. Can I just go back to fighting, guys? Is that cool?
It'll be fine, Brian. We're going to be here sitting here, and you can use the hashtag ThisIsTough on Twitter, and we'll be tweeting along, liking your stuff, and maybe you might even get me on the show. I'll be fact-checking, doing my best. If you find something on Twitter, call me out. Let me know, and I'll make sure you get credit for it. But back to you, Brian. You're not getting out of this.
Yeah, and absolutely, I'm expecting to get the appropriate amount of Twitter hate myself for all my picks. I'm ready to take that. You can find me at Hercules, hit me up all through, I'll be reading those later and crying a little. So I guess we're about ready to get started. Is there anything else I'm not doing before we can get going? I don't want
to... No, you're good to go. I forgot to put up our Apollo Creed thing today, so... Ding, ding. Round one. Let's do it.
You know what? Actually, I'm sorry. I did forget something before round one. You guys might notice I'm wearing the unofficial Fan Fights t-shirt. Can you see this? Is this making
what?
It up?
Nice.
Great, ladies and gentlemen. On T Public, G9 Design, our good friend Janine has some beautiful, not just Tough-related designs. You can get some other good stuff on there, too. But I wanted to give her a shout-out because that's amazing, and I'm just, this is the most comfortable t-shirt. I'll probably never take it off. So...
Please take it off when you challenge.
Dude, watch it close.
Like I said, never take it off. Right, so ding ding, round one. You know, last year, success of Straight Outta Compton, and then last week, the trailer for All Eyes on Me, the Tupac biography, that's eyes with a Z, traditional spelling, came out. So I asked the question for our topic thunder round, what is the best biographical movie about a musician? And I think we're going to start it off with Jack.
Oh, I got to start. All right. So I'm going to choose the 1993 smash hit What's Love Got to Do with It? It is the biography of Tina Turner, and it's a story about her rise to stardom and how she dealt with the abusive relationship she was in with her husband, Ike Turner. So it's a great biopic filled with Tina Turner music, and really it's just a power story about how a woman overcame the abuse of a man to be a successful star. It's fantastic. And I'll talk more about it when it's my turn.
All right, sounds great. Next up, Lang, why don't you give us your pick?
Okay. excuse me for a moment. Have to clear my throat. Okay. When it comes to biopics, especially biopics about musicians, if you're going to do a biopic about somebody, it should be something significant, like did they achieve something. When you do a biopic about a musician, they're usually vain. It's all about, you know, reminiscing about how good their music was or the feeling you have, the goodwill you have towards that artist. And so I went with a different choice for an obscure reason. I don't know how many people have heard of it, but it's a wonderful movie called Immortal Beloved. And it's basically a biopic about Beethoven, but the key difference is it's after his death, and it's actually a mystery wrapped inside actually looking at his entire life. In real life, when Beethoven died, he actually he had a note that basically was written to his immortal beloved, which basically says that you are my life. Basically everything that I've ever done has been for you. And the big mystery of it was, who was he talking about? Was he talking about all the mistresses that he had over time? Was he talking about possibly the one mistress that may have fathered his child, but she was actually, so there's some, you know, you don't know if they're talking about the fact that he actually fathered his own nephew, or is he talking about his music? The reason I picked Immortal Beloved is because it's that tries to take the genre and do something new with it, as opposed to the same thing that we've always seen. And I think it's the best, so.
Oh, sorry, Lang. Can you give me that last point again real quick? I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I said I'll go into more detail about why it's the best later.
Gotcha.
I'm done though. So,
okay. Yep. Go ahead, Amy.
Hi guys. So this is my first time. Sorry if I mess up. Basically, I picked the very best biopic about a musician out there. I went with Sid and Nancy, Love Kills. Basically the story of Sid Vicious and his girl Nancy. Basically, this film is a summary of the entire beginning of the entire punk movement, which I think needs to be known about. There aren't that many films. There are films being told from the punk point of view, but it was the very first time that there was a film basically made that kind of showed the 70s punk movement, which started in the UK with bands like the Sex Pistols, and then, you know, kind of punk bands like the Clash and Joe Strummer. The music throughout the film is absolutely amazing. The film itself kind of chronicles how the Sex Pistols broke up, how that affected punk music as a whole, and how their music kind of affected the rest of any kind of alternative music that followed. If you want to talk about hardcore music or you want to talk about alternative rock, and how their, you know, the music of the punk movement talked about political, social change. It was a catalyst for change. It wasn't just music. The lyrics, Anarchy in the UK, I think everyone, if you don't know that song, you should listen to it. It got a lot of people together that felt like they were outcast and kind of created a community. And this film is the perfect summary of that entire music culture. It's not just about, you know, Sid and Nancy and their relationship, which ultimately was very tragic. It's about punk music as a whole, and it's just a nice overview of everything, and it's very bleak, but at the heart of the film, there is a tender love story that I think, you know, whether you're into punk music or not, that everyone can relate to in some way or another. Done.
All right. Let's go ahead and fight.
See, the problem with Sid and Nancy is that, and you just said it, it's not just about the relationship. And a musical biopic has to center around the artist. That's the main topic of the story. And the biggest problem I had with your movie is that there's no Sex Pistols or Sid Vicious songs in the entire movie. There's a lot of punk music, but none of their music. And, you know, versus, obviously, What's Love Got to Do with It? There's 14 songs in that movie. Every single one is sung by Tina Turner. Everyone. So when you see What's Love Got to Do with It, you are hearing the artist that the movie is about, and you're hearing authentic music set in the time, you know, when the music was sung, and you know, with Sid, and almost the same thing with Immortal Beloved. Immortal Beloved doesn't have, you know, it's Beethoven's played music, but you don't really, you know, Beethoven doesn't get to play his music. You're just hearing songs that he wrote.
How is he supposed to play the music if he's
dead? Hey, I'm just saying, man. They have Tina Turner in my movie.
But see, the actual musician playing the music does not make an actual biopic. A biopic should be about that person, their life, and what effect they had on the world as a whole. Now, I am in agreement with you about Sid and Nancy. My issues with Sid and Nancy, it is a beautiful love letter to punk, but it is not necessarily a succinct biopic about those two people.
Right.
And the people, like, people who knew them best, the actual band, you know, Sex Pistols, like Johnny Rotten, denounced the movie because it doesn't get anything right as far as who those people were. It romanticizes heroin, you know, use, and it also romanticizes the downfall of that particular band. Now, I will give it props because it has probably, well, this movie, you have Gary Oldman giving two performances that are outstanding in his entire career that were never, ever nominated for an Oscar or even recognized. But as far as a biopic is concerned, it doesn't necessarily detail who those people were. Also, with What's Love Got to Do with It, and most biopics are always about, you have this star or this person who likes music, and it's about their rise and eventually their fall. And most of the time, their fall is their own doing. It's What's Got to Do with That, because her fall came from trusting the wrong man. And that's commendable that the movie tries to do something different with that. The only problem is the movie is cookie cutter. It's by the numbers. Everything about What's Love Got to Do with It.
Her life is not by the numbers. There's nothing cookie cutter about Tina Turner's life at all. She struggled, and you want to see that she did overcome. That's the whole purpose of the biopic. She doesn't have to be dead. There is no fall for Tina Turner. There's overcoming for Tina Turner.
But okay. What's Love Got to Do with It? Basically, you've got a singer or a poor person who wants to become a singer. Eventually people recognize that they have a great voice and they're talented. Someone comes into their life and elevates them to become a star. But there's a problem either with fame, drugs, alcohol, or some horrible relationship that they have with the person that brought them up to stardom. And then from that point, they're at rock bottom, and then the star of the movie or the musician in question either comes out of that and becomes the beautiful, wonderful star that we all know and love, or they screw up and they die, and it's depressing.
But that's the thing about my movie.
Of a musical biopic.
My movie is not depressing like the Sid Vicious film at all. It is it's uplifting because you get to watch Tina Turner overcome. Plus, my movie was nominated for two Oscars, for Best Actress in Angela Bassett and for Best Best Actor in Lawrence Fishburne. So my film definitely had the performances needed to get the eyes of the Academy. And Immortal Beloved suffers from the major thing that Immortal Beloved suffers from, especially in the biopic category, is that it's complete speculation as to who Immortal Beloved was, and is fiction, essentially, based... Yeah, well, I want my biopics to have a bit of reality into it. Tina Turner's autobiography, I, Tina.
Guys, let's get Amy in on this. Amy, you got something to say?
Oh, hi, guys. I've got a lot to say.
Okay. Get in there, Amy.
Two things. First, both of your films have been highly contested by actual biographers, historians, Tina Turner, and Ike Turner. Let's start with the Tina Turner film first. I do agree with Langley that it is a generic musician's story. If you want to look at the story of any other musician, a struggling musician, they all start out struggling. There's always a problem. They either rise or they fall. That's kind of how it works.
But that's how all people's lives work. They either rise or they fall.
No, not fandom, though. I mean, most people don't reach the fandom level. The thing about that movie is that there's one very specific scene that never happened in real life. And both Tina and Ike both disputed this. And the scene is basically was a very shocking scene. It was added to build the story and build the shock factor of their story. And I am talking about the rape scene. That never happened in real life. There were misconceptions in that entire movie about what actually happened. For example, there was a woman in the film named Jackie who was her constant friend. That character was created for the film itself. Now, here's the thing. When I'm watching a biopic, I'm thinking of biography, and I want those things to be accurate. I want to watch the real, true, hard story, whether it's depressing.
Johnny Rotten has said the Sid Vicious movie is...
I want to see what's real. I don't want to see a fake friend. I don't want to see a fake rape scene that only had the premise of boosting that abuse factor that was allegedly in their relationship. I'm not writing it off saying she wasn't an abused woman, but I'm saying that everyone has their problems. Tina Turner, she's a pop star. I don't know what she contributed to music as a whole.
Oh my God, you're killing me.
Tina Turner. And you're talking to someone
who's
super, super picky about music. I know my music. I love my films. All right, second, let's go to Langley's choice. Sorry, I'm really sorry about this because I'm a trained classical musician and I absolutely love Beethoven. However, the same thing. and I'm not trying to side with Jack here, but I am a little bit... the main focus of this film is not necessarily Beethoven himself. The story follows his assistant and someone else who they're traveling the world and they're trying to find this mystery woman. And like you said before, it is a mystery and it is exciting, and there are moments of Gary Oldman's amazing scattered throughout the film. But we only really get snippets of his life. We don't really get, you know, it's going on the fact of we already know who Beethoven is. We're already supposed to know about his life. And some viewers might not know anything about him other than dun-dun-dun-dun, right?
See, here's my argument for all of that. Both of you have argued that biopics have to be 100% truthful. I argue that they don't, because here's the thing. All of our movies have fallacies in them. In all accounts, Nancy Spungen ruined Sid's life.
Exactly, and that's portrayed in the film.
That movie makes it sound as if it's a romantic, you know, dream ride that involves fatalism. But here's the thing. All of the movies biopics in general should get to the essence of who the person is, not necessarily the fact of whether this happened or that happened.
Now,
why,
I'm not,
the reason why I picked Immortal Beloved is because it gives you something other than just watching someone's question.
The director.
It gives you something else to think or think on while watching a movie about Beethoven. There are plenty of other standard, boring biopics about Beethoven, and the movie does not say that you have to know or watch anything else to understand this movie. To understand the core of all of our films is that you've got a musician who loves music and who essentially spent their entire life's work towards the best way that they could. And I argue that the way my movie does that makes it better than both of yours.
Okay.
I want to jump in real quick. I think we're going to get close to our closing arguments here. I'm going to try and keep it I'm going to start with Jack. I want everybody to give me, like, a core summary of what they want to say about their movie and one more point about the other movies. Okay.
All right. Well, the first thing I got to address.
Anything. Can anybody hear?
I can hear you, Langley. Can you not hear us? I guess that would be a no.
Hello?
We can hear you. We can hear you, Langley. We can hear you. But we can hear you, but you can't hear us.
Can everybody hear me?
I can.
Okay. All
right. We can hear you, Langley. Someone write a we can hear you on a piece of paper.
Okay.
We can hear you. All right.
I hear you.
All right. Great. So the first thing I got to point out about my movie is the rape scene, because this is kind of pivotal to the entire story of what's Love Got to Do with It. We're doing biopics about musicians, so it's not just biopic. If this category were just about biopics, we could do anyone's biopic. But it's about musicians, and the music is central and key to what we're going to do with this movie versus your other two. Sid Vicious's movie is about punk music more than it's about Sid Vicious, and even Johnny Rotten, to reiterate what Langley said earlier, was appalled, yeah, utterly appalled when he saw the movie. He says, yeah, the only thing they got right about Sid Vicious in that movie was his name. And Immortal Beloved, the thing with Immortal Beloved is it's about who Immortal Beloved is and not about Beethoven's music. Beethoven's music appears in the movie, but we don't really learn that much about how he's writing his music or inspiration for his music, as much as we are seeing the relationship between the two of them. But in my movie, it's based on the autobiography I, Tina. So an autobiography, a book written by Tina Turner. And yes, she says the rape scene did not happen. However, what she did say was that after he would abuse her, he would ask her for sex, and it felt like being raped. And they dramatically took that scene and made it into an actual rape scene, because they had to express her emotions, yeah, and how she felt. So even while the rape scene itself did not happen in real life, she felt that way when he would proposition her after being abused. And it was a representation of that, and it accomplished the shock value that was necessary to really tell you, like, what Tina Turner had to go through. But Tina Turner's music, you get to watch Tina Turner be Tina Turner in this film.
For Langley, I got you, Jack. You're good.
All right. Go for it, Langley.
Yeah, say that again. Oh, okay. Cool.
It's you.
Closing argument.
Final thoughts.
Okay. All right. Okay. Is concerned, it, like you said, is not a biopic necessarily in the way that it's accurate, nor does it actually celebrate the life of that person that it's supposed to be about, or the band that he was a part of. But What's Love Got to Do with It, also, like a lot of biopics, and this is why I am not a particular fan of biopics, it's that biopics always, unless they're really good, are usually either in two directions. They're either this musician was just wonderful and great and did nothing wrong and everything was wonderful with that person, or they were a shit show. And What's Love Got to Do with It? Yeah, it comes from her autobiography, but you just illustrated exactly why it has inconsistencies and inaccuracies where, oh, she felt like she was raped, so we're just going to show that she was raped, even though it
didn't
happen.
But at least most of the movie is about her.
I get that is used to create a mood, and that's fine, I mean, because all of these are fiction. And this is why I argue that It is not important that the biopic actually be 100% accurate that this thing happened and this thing happened. It's that you get the essence of the people involved. What's all got to do with it gives us a pretty picture of who Tina Turner was, but does not give us all of it. And CNNC doesn't actually give us an honest representation of who those people were when most of the people who actually knew them on a regular basis completely disagrees with the film and even says that they were never even talked to about what happened or transpired in that movie.
All right, thanks, Lightly. I got you. Amy, close us out.
Okay, I'm going to go back to the question here. It was best musician, okay? It wasn't best music biopic. Musician and music, two very different things. Actual musician here. We're not necessarily concerned with the music that's in the movie. However, the musician makes the music and has a part of it. I don't think that the argument against Sid and Nancy not having a lot of Sex Pistols music in it really makes that much of a difference. Because we have the Clash, we have the Pogues, we have the Circle Jerks, we have all extremely influential punk rock bands of that time who changed the music scene forever. I mean, it was something that changed forever. At the heart of the film, it is a love story. It is the rise and the tragic, tragic fall of Sid Vicious. When you think of the Sex Pistols, you don't think Johnny Rotten. The only reason Johnny Rotten was so angry was because he was portrayed in a real light. That's really who Johnny Rotten was. Sid Vicious came into that band because they needed someone like him. He wasn't an original member. He came in after the other guy was kicked out because he liked the Beatles. Okay? So, I don't like the Beatles. Uh-oh. Neither does anyone who's really into punk music. Basically,
oh my God, you're just killing me today.
Oh yeah, I'm on fire.
Am I the only
basically,
one that...
the film itself is about, it doesn't romanticize heroin, and it doesn't romanticize suicide, or the way that he killed the love of his life, and the struggles that he went through, and how this music changed him. It is a real hard, tough look at these things that affected musicians during that time in the early 70s. Heroin was running rampant. It's not a generic story.
Got anything else? Give me some knockdown. Got anything else to say about What's Love or Immortal Lovin' that we haven't already hit yet?
Okay, I do. So, again, I'm going to go over the same thing again. What's Love got to do with it? Characters recreated that never existed just to advance the film. I don't agree with that. I want to see something real. I want to see something true. The rape scene, not cool. It's not cool to put that in a movie if it never happened. Rape is a serious thing, and it shouldn't be used as a catalyst in a film. That's supposed to be about something that actually happened when that didn't happen at all. Immortal Beloved, the director himself, Bernard Rose, solved the mystery, which every single historian has said is incorrect. So again, it's not true. I want to see something that's real. I want to see something that's true. I want to know who Immortal Beloved is. The director solved the mystery himself by saying that the woman is Joanna. This was never proved by historians. It was never proved by anyone else, and actual biographers completely dispute this. So while the film itself is interesting, it doesn't really give you the true story. And that's pretty much all I have to say.
I think that's a perfect place to stop. I think I got everything I need.
I'm so sorry, Tina Turner and the Beatles.
This is a difficult...
Do you want us to check the facts first?
Yeah, go ahead and give me some facts, so I'll look over my notes a little bit while you guys talk.
All right, well, everybody said was pretty clean. What's Love Got to Do is actually the highest rated on Rotten Tomatoes with a 96%.
Yes, it is.
Immortal Beloved with a 58%, and Sid and Nancy with a 91%. Fun fact, Courtney Love auditioned for the role of Nancy. She was a junkie friend in the film. But she would later marry Kurt Cobain, and they would
that
be compared.
Invented.
The couples would be compared often.
Nice. Twitter's nice and active right now. Billy, Morgan, and Trevor are excited to see Jack fight.
Thanks, guys.
We have a couple alternate choices. Billy at B-Buster Bill went with Amadeus, which I'm sure you guys would all know is my choice. We also got Love for Ray and Walk the Line out there.
Excellent.
Also, just shout out to Amy. I'm a punk rock girl, and I don't like the Beatles either. You got some love from other people as well online. And I'm sure probably some people disagreeing. And Ashley is tuning in from the Starbucks drive-thru right now.
Hey, Ash.
Close your heart, Ashley.
And I have those polls whenever you're ready.
All right. Well, looking over my notes here, you know, I think I'm going to start. I'm going to narrow the field a little bit. You know, Amy, I think you had some good points and stuff, but I think they did knock you down with, you know, the other members of Sex Pistols coming out against the film and also not having, you know, the actual music of Sid and the Sex Pistols, I think, hurts it overall. I think they made some good points there. I also think it's hard to quantify a band's effect on music. I mean, that's very subjective to your taste, so it's hard to kind of, you know, so I was trying to, you know, go around that. So, good fighting, Amy, but I think this round came down to Jack and Langley. I like the points Langley was making about the non-traditional style of biopic. You know, it's more of a mystery, it's a kind of a genre bender, but also, you know, Jack and Amy were right in that it's less about Beethoven and it's more about the mystery. You know, maybe I would have liked if Langley, if you could have hit up on some other biopics that focus more on like a particular time in a person's life, like Lincoln. Well, it's not about musicians, but
well, for the record, I actually picked What's Love Got to Do with It. So
yeah, I know. And my wife is very happy to hear that it's got that much love out there in the community. She thought she was the only one. But yeah, I think this round's gonna go to Jack overall. He had some good knocks. He had some good points to make. You know, Oscar noms for the actors, authentic music, and despite, I mean, the Beethoven music is authentic. It's just not performed by him. I'm not holding that against it, but I do think, What's Love has some really great music in it. And, also the story, even though I do agree that you shouldn't, there's certain things that you do to add emotion to your movie. All biopics do that. You know, so I'm gonna let that ride, even though, you know, I think we talked a little bit too much about rape today already. So maybe
it's important. We love you, Tina Turner. Woo!
First round goes to Jack. Good job, guys.
Woo! All right, good fight, guys.
Yeah. Wow.
That was rough.
I'm gonna go ahead and agree with you on that one. What's Love got 57%, followed by Sid and Nancy at 29 and Immortal Beloved at 14.
And I don't know if this is
no
a
one's seen it.
But we're editing last week's OSP, which was on biopics. So look forward to that coming out.
Can I just say that I almost never watch biopics? So this is a really tough round for me.
Yeah.
I get them. That's like
very tough.
Belief on them, you know what I mean? Like, I had a hard time with Straight Outta Compton at times. I was like, sketchy on this there. Good
well
movie.
Done.
All right, so we ready for round two?
I found it.
Let's do it.
This question was rattling around my brain. I kind of got obsessed with it. So for a comic book movie round, I wanted to ask, what is the best comic book movie to come out in what I would consider the Dark Ages, which would be between Batman 1989 and Blade 1998? We had a period there where we were very hit and miss on our comic book adaptations. And since we're all of a similar generation, and that's going to play into a later question, I wanted us all to talk about the best comic book movie from the Dark Ages. So this time I think I'm going to have Langley start us out.
Oh, okie dokie. Well, to begin with, just to give you some background, you know how everybody, I'm sure all of us that are movie fans, we all have that one movie that we saw when we were young that made us go, oh, my God, you can do that with a movie? Like, movies, you know, I want to be a part of that. And for a lot of people, that's Star Wars, and I like Star Wars. I appreciate it. Like, I saw Return of the Jedi when I was 3 years old, remember every moment of it. But the movie that did get it for me was 1989's Batman. Now, considering the question is what's in between Batman and Blade, I went with Batman Returns, and here's why. A lot of people try to dismiss this movie, but what is awesome about Batman Returns is that this is Tim Burton at his peak, and what I appreciate about Batman Returns is because it's a sequel to an already successful film that pretty much reinterpreted Batman for mainstream. With the sequel, Tim Burton was able to go hog wild and actually, like, if you really sit back and describe Batman and his rogues gallery and take all the heroism out of it, they are some effed up, strange, weirdo loners. And that is exactly what Tim Burton is. And Batman Returns is pretty much an ode, a love letter to weirdness. And because of that, like, a lot of people complain that, you know, oh, they, you know, because of Batman Returns being too dark or too weird, it somehow tainted the success and the mainstream appeal of Batman. Get that Batman is weird. A guy with a lot of money dresses up like a bat to fight crime. And he goes up against other characters and people who are dressed up like animals, a penguin, a cat. And so what I liked about Batman Returns is that it actually took those elements of Batman and did something magnificent with it. It turned it into this twisted, funny, but at the same time not campy adventure with Batman. And it gave us, frankly, the only, well, in my opinion, the best Catwoman we've ever seen. So I'll go into more detail about why the movie is great, but yeah, Batman Returns, 1992 for me.
All right, next up we're going to go with Amy.
All right. I don't know how I can follow up to Batman Returns, but...
But you're going to try.
I'm going to try. So, my favorite... We're sticking with favor, right?
Not it's that. Okay. It all works.
Okay. I'm going to go with a blockbuster, a time when summer blockbusters still existed. I think we can agree that this summer's been kind of a flop so far. I picked Men in Black and primetime Will Smith. He was at his best. Again, the film's 1997. It's based on comic books of the same name. 90, 91. There are 3 issues each year, 6 issue total. After that, the film came out. Marvel picked it up, bought the company, did a lot of one-shots, very successful. Again, the film overall was almost $600 million. It was something different. It wasn't your typical comic book. They did lighten the tone a little bit to make it more of a comedy. But in the end, Will Smith is in it. And the film did great at the box office. And people love this movie. They love it so much that the studio is, for some reason, I'm not going to say it's not going to be awesome because it is. They're doing a crossover with Men in Black and 22 Jump Street. The film is still relevant today. People know what you're talking about. When you say Batman Returns, you're like, oh, you know, which Batman movie was that? I'm not really sure. I don't really know which one that was. When you say Men in Black, you think Will Smith. You think the sunglasses. You think the neuralizer. Done. Next.
All right. Give it to us.
All right. So here's the thing. When you're talking about the dark ages of comic book movies, you want a movie that stands out on every level. And that is why I chose 1994's The Crow. The Crow is based, is a comic from Caliber Comics. It was first released in 1989. And The Crow takes the story of Eric Draven, who is a musician, and his girlfriend. They live in an apartment tenement building, and they're basically being forced to move by the local thug. And they send a group of thugs to the apartment, and in the end, both characters get killed. the Crow, using its spiritual powers of unexplained awesomeness, raises Eric Draven from the dead so that he can get his revenge on the people who murdered his fiance. The thing with Batman in this era is that Batman was on the rise. Like the first Batman, the Joker, the one with the Joker in '89, showed you that comic book superheroes can be made into films and be successful. The problem with Batman Returns is they said, well, let's just throw the kitchen sink at Batman. Batman Returns is almost not about Batman. It's about the villains, Penguin, Catwoman, and Max Schreck. And Men in Black is not necessarily Will Smith at the height of his powers. It's Will Smith from every movie. That's the same Will Smith we see in Independence Day. It's the same Will Smith that takes songs that we all love from the 70s and rewrites them for the theme music. The Crow is an original piece of music, and what makes it really amazing is that the lead actor, Brandon Lee, died filming the film. It was the only film you know Brandon Lee from. He made 7 movies. This is the movie you'll know, and it's his last one. The bullet that killed the character Eric Draven is the bullet that killed Brandon Lee. So there's lots of great history and story behind my film, and I'll talk about it a little bit more as we get into the fight.
All right. Fight.
Well, as far as Batman Returns is concerned, we already got a lot about Batman in the first Batman film. So, yes, we do spend a lot of time focusing on his villains, and we have 2 villains, yes. And I will admit, at the time, it didn't seem like overkill, but eventually people seem to take that. If you have 2 villains, that's great. Let's add to it. But this is the movie where it actually works to have multiple villains. And I'll give you, okay, Batman Returns is also amazing because at the same time, they basically have created the first and, to my mind, the only actual original villain that is not from the comic books that actually works in a Batman film, and that is Max Schreck, played by the legendary, why can't I think of his freaking name? Christopher Walken, oh my god.
I couldn't help you, but I wanted to.
Christopher Walken and his weird portrayal of essentially a megalomaniac corporate raider in comparison with Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman works on so many levels, both as far as comedy, action, but also just creep factor. Like, a lot of people try to dismiss this movie as being campy or that it's too over the top or it's not good. I completely disagree. It celebrates the of Batman, and Batman is freaking weird when you really think about it.
Now, well, that's the problem. It's a weird choice. There's so much happening in your movie that you can't follow any of the storylines to any logical conclusion.
Yes, you can. You absolutely can. But besides, okay, as far as The Crow is concerned, I'm going to say something that is probably will sound really, really harsh, and it's completely... it's true, but a lot of people don't want to admit. One of the only reasons that people praise The Crow so much is because Brandon Lee died while making that movie. And sad to say, number one, Brandon Lee was not a good actor. And if he had lived, I honestly don't think The Crow would be as praised or put up on a pedestal as it is to this day. Also, The Crow movie isn't even all that, accurate or beholden to the actual comic books.
Well, neither is yours. Max Schreck doesn't exist in the comics, so neither is yours on that argument.
But the essence of Batman is correct.
All right, guys.
The essence of who Batman is absolutely correct.
Guys.
Also, Men in Black is basically the Will Smith show.
Yeah!
So I was just thought you were speaking. I don't want to talk over anybody.
There's nothing wrong with the Will Smith show at that point in time. Now, questionable. After Earth, definitely not a good movie. However, there was nothing wrong with the Will Smith show at that time. It was something original. It was something new. It was different than the comic book movies we were used to seeing. First.
But I would argue that it's different from the essence of the comic books because they made it into the Will Smith show where he's playing the exact same character that he did in Independence Day. It's just Big Willie style with aliens and Men in Black, which they aren't even, like, Men in Black are supposed to be menacing. They're supposed to be creepy. They're not creepy at all. They're not intimidating. It's basically just a cartoon show.
Wow. You're really dissing on Will Smith right now. Okay, can I say two things about the other films? First thing. Batman Returns was so forgettable that I, as a huge fan of Batman, cannot even remember who played Batman in that film. Yep.
You can't remember who played Batman in Batman Returns?
Nope.
The great Michael Keaton?
Michael Keaton. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I have to defend Langley
that
on
movie,
this one.
Yeah, that movie adds to the legacy that the first Batman created. Basically, when they made Batman, everybody was nervous about could this work, and they proved that it could work. Batman Returns just expounds on that and makes an even bigger, weirder, wonderful world out of it. And it's Tim Burton. It's the, in my opinion, it's the most Tim Burton of superhero movies ever.
Well, Tim Burton is a definitely acquired taste. I'm going to say that basically for a lot of Batman fans, nothing happened for Batman between that 1989 film and The Dark Knight. I think most Batman films fans want to forget about all those movies because they were trash. Next.
I know you got nothing bad to say about The Crow, because Crow's awesome.
The Crow. You know what? The Crow made a lot of angry, goth, middle school kids happy.
Exactly.
You know, again, Brandon Lee, shitty actor. You know, I'm sorry that he died on set. Again, his death made that movie popular. Would anyone even watch that film if it weren't for his death? And I'm gonna say no.
Yes.
I'm gonna say no and watch it.
It's a great movie.
Did anyone watch the sequels? Did anyone enjoy the sequels? Nope, not at all.
I have seen the sequels. They're not as good, but that's not the question, obviously.
The sequels were an abomination. To the film. And basically, you know, the only thing that they got out of making that film was his death perpetuated the box office numbers. People wanted to see the film because of all this mysticism that surrounded it. But that's all it was. It was just mysticism and, you know, conspiracy theories about this and that. You know, Brandon Lee's not a good actor. And would the film really be good? Is it an actually a good film if it weren't for him dying on set? And the answer is no.
I think what you're wanting to say, though, is that his dying on set got the film to be seen, and would people have seen the movie had he not died? And I would say the answer would probably be no. So if anything, his death helped people see what ended up being a good movie, because this is actually a very good and entertaining film. It has action throughout, way more interesting action than the action from Men in Black, which every fight scene in Men in Black, we had to hear Will Smith making jokes, where in The Crow,
supposed to entertain us, not depress us.
We just lost Brian.
Never stops raining.
We just lost Brian, and I can't win while Brian's gone. So let's wait till Brian gets back.
I'm back.
All right, good, because everyone just agreed while you were gone, Brian, that The Crow is the best movie. You didn't hear it when it happened. We also lost Langley, so we're just going to bring... Hey, everybody, it's the Internet. Welcome to the Internet.
Yes.
Here comes Langley. Welcome back, Langley. I was just telling Brian how you admitted... I just told Brian how you admitted that The Crow was the best movie. So he appreciated that and awarded me the point. We're on to round three.
Round's over.
No, but The Crow... So The Crow, we're talking about The Crow, the awesomeness that is The Crow. So admittedly, would people have seen The Crow as readily if he hadn't died? Probably not. I didn't know what the Crow was until Brandon Lee had died, but I knew who Bruce Lee was, and Brandon Lee was his son. And the mystery of the fact that people didn't know why Brandon Lee was killed, and there was mystery surrounding the death of Bruce Lee, was a point that brought me to the theater. But when I got to the theater, I was entertained. And not only by the film, the soundtrack to this movie is a tour de force of great bands from that era, like The Cure, Machines of Loving Grace, Stone Temple Pilots, Nine Inch Nails, Rage Against the Machine, Violet Femmes, the Rollins Band, Pantera, and although no one knows it, the My Life with a Thrill Kill Cult, who no one has ever heard of since, does the coolest song in that movie. The fight scene at the club is to their song, and it's amazing. And then Jane Silbury does It Can't Rain All the Time, which was Eric Draven's song. It's her version of it, which is a beautiful piece and is played during the credits. Everything about this movie is fantastic. It's, yeah, they're not Oscar-winning performances, but it's an action comic movie, and it's a movie you can sit through and enjoy throughout, from beginning to end. It's fantastic.
Yeah, basically to me, that movie is essentially Hot Topic, the movie. It basically made everybody who wanted to be goth cool again by watching The Crow. It's like, I want to be like that. I'm going to wear black, and I'm going to put on makeup. Sorry, it doesn't fly as the
your
best
movie,
of these particular movies.
Batman Returns started the horrific trend of throwing as many superheroes into a film as we possibly could. You have
he's working now, by the way. It does
no, it's,
it now.
It, yeah, it's working in a better way now, but there's a lot of there's a long period of time, including in the Batman franchise, because then they added Robin. Then they have the Joker and the Riddler and Two-Face and Mr. Freeze. They're just throwing everyone into these movies instead of building on the characters that they have. They don't tell you, what do you know about Max Schreck other than that he's some sort of corporate guy? That's all you know about Max Schreck.
That's all you need to know.
The Penguin is barely even the Penguin in that movie, and you don't grow to love his character as a villain the way you love Heath Ledger's The Joker in The Dark Knight. They're just passing fads in that movie. Selina Kyle is hot as Catwoman, but does she really bring anything meaningful to the film? Like, no. And her origin story is ridiculous in that movie.
No, see, okay, it has multiple villains. It's one of the first to have multiple villains, and it actually does it well. The fact that you just mentioned that every Batman and other superhero film like the pie on villains is a testament to a film like this doing it first and doing it the best. People saw that and said, oh, we should try that. Also, as far as having multiple villains, yes, you have Selina Kyle as Catwoman, who you can argue is an anti-hero, or at the very least a romantic interest. And then you have the Penguin and Max Schreck. Max Schreck represents something in Batman films that only the first Batman film and the Dark Knight trilogy got correct. And that is the fact that Gotham, besides the costume villains, Gotham has a deep-seated underbelly of corruption and the mob that don't wear costumes that are already causing problems, and you need Batman to take care of that. You add on top of that people like the Penguin, and as far as the Penguin is concerned, he's an excellent version of the Penguin, except he's creepy, and I like that, because it's like, why would the person call themselves the Penguin? Everyone else calls him the Penguin because he's deformed. And it's also this great juxtaposition between, like in the movie he says, both Max Schreck and Bruce Wayne were born with a silver spoon in their mouth. And the Penguin, he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, but got dumped in the sewer because he didn't look like everybody else. Now, I actually think that's a much better interpretation than if you just made, like, I'll give you a horrible example, Gotham, the Penguin on Gotham. He's basically just, there is no nuance development as to why he's called the Penguin that works. Danny DeVito as the Penguin is great. And on top of it, he's intimidating and menacing, which the Penguin had never been up until that point.
You know who does really good with multiple villains? The Crow. You learn everything you need to know about T-Bird, Fun Boy, Tintin, Skank in the short period that they're on the film. having that many villains doesn't detract from the film. It just adds to The Crow. And Michael Wincott, as Top Dollar, is a fantastic lead villain in that movie. He's strong. He's confident. He isn't inept. He's a worthy challenger to The Crow. The final fight is satisfying. There's a moment where, you know, The Crow could actually lose, and you feel like there's actual stakes in that movie because of his portrayal of that character. And Ernie Hudson is a very sympathetic character as Sergeant Albrecht. And aside from Ghostbusters, we hadn't really even seen Ernie Hudson do performances the way he did it in The Crow, and he's been performing since 1976. The man has a huge library to credits to his name, but this one I think is often overlooked. But he believed a lot in this film. In fact, he wasn't sure that they should release the movie after the death because he was just unsure of were they doing the right thing for Brandon. But then, you know, everyone convinced him. It's like, no, like we did an important thing here. We have to show this film. But, you know, when it comes to being original, The Crow is a really original storyline. We don't really see a lot of movies like it, in a time when, Batman is kind of cookie cutter superhero, even for the time period. We weren't seeing a lot of superhero movies, but.
Alright, here I want Amy to get in. I think we're almost there. Amy, can you give me some final thoughts?
Alright, final thoughts. Again, I think there's a few things when it comes to determining the best. And I do think there's a formula, and I don't think it's, a personal choice. I think that one, how well the film does at the box office. It's a measurement of the audience, what they think of the film. Number two, critics. Critics matter. I'm saying this because I'm in the industry and I respect I honestly respect the writing and I respect the opinions of certain critics. And number three, rewatchability. I can watch Men in Black today and have just as much fun as I did in 1997 and not think it's a completely ridiculously stupid film. The reason I can do that is because it won an Academy Award. You know, best makeup, best creature makeup. It was a film before CGI was in every single movie. There were actual actors underneath the bug. There were actual people as aliens. It's fun. It's a fun entertainment.
I'm with you, Langley. There's a lot of CGI in that movie.
It's yeah. There, but I'm saying the characters aren't all CGI. It won an Academy Award for best makeup. I mean, that's kind of a hard thing to do, to create a person, turn them into an alien using makeup. Those things don't exist anymore, which is sad. I totally agree. However, they weren't just smearing black paint on their faces to be The Crow. Let's go back to The Crow for a second. This is a tough one for me because, you know, The Crow gave a bunch of goth kids something to believe in. It gave them a sense of belonging, and maybe it was an outlet for them at the time. The film itself is just goofy and ridiculous, and it's just so goofy and ridiculous that it's not a believable film as what it's trying too hard. It's trying too hard to be something that it's not. It's trying to be this, you know, unrequited love story, the story of revenge, but they just don't do it well. It's just not a good film. They don't do that storyline well. Men in Black, it's a comedic, fun, entertaining film, and they do it perfectly. Batman Returns, again, like I said, I don't think anything good with Batman happened between Batman 89 and the Dark Knight trilogy. A lot of ridiculous things happened with that character. You know, Tim Burton kind of made that film for himself. He didn't make it for the audience. He didn't make it for the fans. That's why it was so freaking weird and ridiculous, because that's the kind of person he is. Like I said, he has a very,
I'm calling it, guys. I got it. I got it, guys. Can you help me out with a little, fact-checking?
Everything was, pretty clean. A lot of it was opinions.
Sure.
Some of them I may not agree with, but I'll keep that to myself. Rotten Tomatoes gives Crow an 82%, Men in Black a 92%, and Batman Returns an 80%. Batman Returns and Men in Black both having beautiful scores by Danny Elfman.
So Janine and Raul are out there tweeting so much love for Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman. I'm a big fan myself. I personally really love all three of these movies, so it physically pained me to hear you guys say some of the things that you guys did.
I actually do too.
Out there for also Blade, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and the Toxic Avenger as choices. And I happen to be the goth kid that liked The Crow, and Raul tweeted out that also Kylo Ren, it would make him happy. And nice. I'll have your poll results when you're ready.
Okay, well, yeah, so I'm going to take a couple things off the table here. You know, comic accuracy, I think, is a hard thing to fight. There hasn't really been a lot of super comic accurate comic book movies. You have to get the theme down. I guess that's the key. So I'm kind of pulling that out a little bit. Also, I'm taking the terrible sequels thing off the table. I don't think anybody in this group wants to fight about sequels. All these movies have terrible sequels.
Yeah, they do.
We'll just move away from that. I think that they hit you up pretty bad, Langley, at some things. I think it was a little too much Tim Burton and not enough Batman. I think that is arguable. I think the Hot Topic thing, Tim Burton and his movies did just as much for Hot Topic as The Crow, so you kind of have to take that out of the equation too. I really had to narrow it down to Men in Black and The Crow. And I really think you guys were sleeping on Men in Black a little bit. I don't think you took me seriously enough. You didn't hit her very hard.
No, I was going to hit it hard. You didn't give me my final thought.
I was letting you guys talk a lot. And I wanted to, I'm trying not to let it go too long. I'm trying to be conscious.
It's all good.
No, but she did note the tone change from the comic. But she didn't give me enough of why they changed the tone and what made that successful and why that was a good change. She did have some good stuff in there, though, about it just flat out being a well-liked movie and everybody got behind it. But I think that Jack was able to defend his points the best. I think that especially the one where you guys made people go in, maybe, but it didn't make people love the movie. Had they gone in and just seen a bad movie after Brandon Lee died, they'd have seen it the one time, but I don't think it would have lasted the way it did. I do think the soundtrack was impactful at the time, for sure. So I guess I'm going to have to go with Jack on this one.
I can't believe I won that round. Oh my God. I'm clapping for myself. I can't believe I won that. Good job, guys.
I don't want to give Jack these points because of my shutout last time. I'm really just feeling I was hoping to run him into the ground.
What did the poll say?
Twitter's going to hard disagree with you on this one.
Fair enough.
Batman Returns had a 67% from people, followed by Men in Black at 22 and The Crow with 11.
I voted for Langley on Twitter.
Oh, you gotta be kidding me.
I wanted to pick your movie, and then I was like, no, you know, Batman is the one I would pick, so let's try to pick something and fight it. And then I was just like, man, he's killing me on Batman. So good job, good fight, Dan, okay, man. I lost that round. I did not think I was gonna win that one. Nice job.
I actually wanted to pick Batman.
That was tough because I love The Crow.
I know she does so much,
and I know it's this ridiculous, silly, goofy movie, but I love it, and I love Batman Returns. So it's like I don't want to say bad about it. Anything bad.
Yep.
Batman Returns is my favorite Batman movie, and Keaton is my Batman.
That's the game.
Yeah, Keaton is my Batman as well. Yep. I mean, he is a Batman. He's the first, and he's the best.
Brian, just do me a favor. Can you signal out just to be sure when you actually want us to give a final argument so I know that's the end of it?
Sorry, I agree. I think I jumped the gun a little bit on that. I'm sorry, guys.
That's all right.
I just don't want to be the guy.
But I won, so I have no complaint.
You know, I want to be the guy who keeps the show moving. Not like I could sit and listen to you guys argue, like, for a real – it's really entertaining. I'm not going to lie. So I, like, consciously – okay, I need to get this moving. So sorry about that. I'll try to pay attention there.
So let's do a pitch round. That'll go fast.
Run long, right? That's a totally
because we do have to drive to Jersey after this.
You're like, guys, argue faster. All right.
So top three, everybody.
Ding, ding. I don't have it ready to go.
Okay, ding, ding it is. So this round was a good, and my good I specified for these guys, well-regarded overall, critically acclaimed, well-regarded by critics for the most part, popular, successful, so I don't, none of this is going to be arguing about are these movies good. I've approved them as quote-unquote good movies, okay? So the idea is to pitch a good movie that you wouldn't mind seeing a remake of. And we're going to start with Amy this time.
Oh my goodness. Okay, well, this is going to be interesting, guys. My pick is a retelling, I'm going to say a modern retelling of Badlands 74. It was Malick's first film where he attempted to blend violence and beauty. Do you want to know who I cast? Yes?
Yes, do it.
Okay. So, the first character, his name's Kit. He's a street kid, 1950s, doesn't really have much going on with himself. He's kind of a loser, per se. Not the kind of guy that you want your daughter to be dating. So for him, originally it was Martin Sheen, who, spectacular performance, by the way, for the time. I picked Taron Egerton, and I think that we know that he has the chops to pull off this street kid vibe, because he's done it in Kingsman. For the young, vulnerable girl in the film, kind of a case of Stockholm Syndrome here, as we would call it today, but not necessarily then, because things were more accepted. I picked Zoe Kravitz, and I picked her because if we're doing a modern retelling, I don't want to see, again, I don't want to see two white kids. I want to see some diversity. I want to see some diversity in my films, and I think if we're doing something modern of a crime spree that was actually happened, I want to see modern retelling of that crime spree. I want to see diversity, and I want to see better use of trying to blend that violence and beauty. And for my director, I picked Nicholas Winding Refn because he's at the top of his game. He's easily the best director that has successfully made violence look and feel beautiful.
Real quick, Amy, can I get a clarification? Is this our modernizing and bringing it into
today? I couldn't hear you.
You're cutting out. Say that again, Brian.
I was asking, is this a modern retelling or is this set in the 50s?
It's a modern retelling.
Okay,
using the facts from the crime spree. That was a true story.
Okay. True story, but you're modernizing it into the current. Okay, that's what I want to make sure. All right, go ahead, Jack.
All right, so, we're pitching a good movie that we wouldn't mind seeing remade, and I'm going to pick Predator. Arnold Schwarzenegger's Predator. Now, we all know that they are working on a Predator remake. To throw all that aside, this is my Predator movie. This is the movie that I would want to tell. And the first thing you need to know is the characters are the same, even though the actors will be different. And this is a modern retelling. So we're going to have – the Predator is going to come to Earth now. We're going to update some of the technology while at the same time keeping the same feel of Predator that we loved, the close quarters, the jungle, the – that feel. And we're going to take a little modern bent on it. Dutch – is still has a rescue team that he works with, and he goes around the world doing missions for the military, rescuing people. and he is commissioned to rescue a CIA operative operating out of Rotina, Brazil, which, if you're familiar with, it's Rotina, I believe. If you're familiar with Rotina, it's a giant favela. It's, you've seen it in movies like, Incredible Hulk with, Edward Norton. That's a favela. So it's those really tight in buildings kind of built on a mountain. There's a CIA operative in that favela, and the team has to go rescue them. But when they get there, they find out that it's Dylan, the CIA operative, from the original movie. And he's actually used the team as his rescue, but also to help him clear, and escape from Rotina. And they make it, out into the jungle. And while they're in the jungle, they're being pursued by the cartel, Dylan was working against. And in the night, while they're trying to escape, they hear screams and gunfire. And when they go to investigate the gunfire, what do they find but skin bodies hanging from trees with their skulls missing. And then that's when the real fun begins. And then we're going to go through Brazilian jungle again, essentially kind of updating and retelling the story, but with different characters. We're not going to be, using quotes. Arnold Schwarzenegger does not appear in this film. Everybody knows who Arnold is. He doesn't need to make an appearance. He will not be in the film. Who will be playing Dutch though? Carl Urban, along with director Pete Travis, who is the director of Dredd. Pete Travis has a real, strong environmental bent. If you look at Peachtree Towers from Dredd, the tower itself is almost as much a character in Dredd as Carl Urban's character was. And I really like the way he tells stories environmentally. Plus, the favela has to be a character for those sequences of the film as much as the jungle does. So Pete Travis was my pick. Carl Urban is a great lead actor. I want to see him in more things. His portrayal as Dredd alone is amazing. He's got a charisma that people want to follow him. But for the most part, I want to use brand new actors for all of the other characters. I want to highlight new, while my film doesn't center around diversity, I certainly want a diverse team, but I don't have specific actors in mind to kind of represent diversity, but it's not going to be all white. An all-white cast. I definitely want people, Brazilians, Hispanics, everyone to be in the film. But it's not really the focus of the pitch. But that's my movie, the Predator remake.
All right, great. And go ahead, Langley.
Okay. Let me take a picture for you. As basically, everyone talks about space, and sometimes even the ocean as the new frontier we have here. But what we don't recognize is that the actual frontier that we can explore is inside all of us. And that is a remake of Fantastic Voyage. But we rename it Cortex. I was trying to come up with really lame, they came off like lame catchphrases as far as the poster is concerned, but I'm not going to bore you with that because I can't think of any. But basically, if you don't know what Fantastic Voyage is, essentially a team of scientists that have figured out how to miniaturize things has to go, in both the original and in my story, it begins with basically, it's a corporate espionage tale in which there is a man is unconscious. He has a blood clot because there was an attempted assassination. And he supposedly has key information that will lead to saving a whole bunch of lives as far as terrorism is concerned. So the NSA sends an agent to this actually figured out how to miniaturize I wouldn't want to call it a submarine, but it's a vehicle like that in which we can actually attack the body's illnesses from the inside. And the scientists I'll go to the cast. For the cast, I have Tatiana Maslany as the actual scientist who has invented the technology, and her mentor is Helen Mirren. And the entire reason that they are even developing the technology is because Helen Mirren is dying of a pretty much an inoperable cancer in her brain. And the only way that they think they can fix it is by actually literally going inside of her body and combating it. But the research is basically taken over and occupied by a representative from the NSA who basically tells them, you know, this is a life or death matter. We have to go inside. We need to fix this guy's blood clot as soon as possible because, you know, a lot of people could die. Now, what happens is you have a team of scientists that are inside the Proteus, which is basically a better word, and everything seems hunky-dory. They're going in. They're going to try to take out this blood clot using technology, also using, in the original film they had lasers, but we're not doing that. Basically, we're going with micro, you're basically using, micro robotics in a attack cells. Yes, thank you. Nanites, thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh. So, you're using nanites to attack your technology, but here's the thing, there's a twist and it becomes an action movie. At the same time, while they're inside of the body, and they can only stay in for a limited amount of time, and also the NSA officer is played by Nate Parker, who is, you can sense that he's not telling the truth about everything as far as this spy that has been attacked and is near death. And so what happens is they think that the mission is going along just fine, but at the same time, the facility that they are in gets attacked Die Hard style because someone, and this is just not as a poet, one, and in the process of the film, we find out that the blood clot itself actually isn't a blood clot. It's actually also nanite technology that was implanted. It's all been a big ruse in order to steal the actual technology for themselves. And the bad guy is played by Javier Bardem. And on two fronts, you have this voyage inside the human body that can be updated with special effects. And at the same time, you have this diehard tale where you have Helen Mirren in the facility with her team of scientists, also having to try and keep Javier Bardem outside outside of the facility while they're trying to, at first, fix this person's brain tumor, but at the same time, they find out that they have to get out because it turns out it's all one big ruse. One of the people on board, the actual shuttle, actually is in league with Javier Bardem, and we don't know who it is. The director for this film, I want somebody who is good at action, sci-fi, but at the same time is also good at remakes, and that's J.J. Abrams. Give him something that, the reason I wanted to make a remake of Fantastic Voyage is because not many people have heard of it other than just the concept, and most people don't want to, you shouldn't remake movies that are already masterpieces, that are already great. You have Cortex, directed by J.J. Abrams, starring Tatiana Maslany, Nate Parker, Helen Mirren, and Javier Bardem. That's my pitch. I'll go into more details, but.
All right. So I'm going to let you guys fight. I just want to say, don't just focus on hacking the other ones, but tell me why yours is the best idea for a remake, why it deserves to be remade, what the remake is going to bring to the in this new version.
Well, you know, Predator is one of those stories that they've been trying to retell since the original, and they just haven't really quite nailed it. And I think when you go back, even the Predators movie, the one with the S, where they were like, oh, we're going to try to put it back in the woods. But I think, again, they were trying to go too spacey. They were trying to add, there's, five or six Predators in that movie. I want to go back to the same kind of terror that Aliens kind of gives you, in that you have a single alien. No one's ever seen it before. And I want to change my Predator around a little bit, too. We're not going to go quite the same way. You know, at the end of the film, when they defeat the Predator, some things are going to happen that are going to seem at first familiar. I want to have a wrist thing that starts counting down when he dies, and everybody's going to be like, oh, is that a countdown? Is he going to explode? But no, he doesn't explode. The suit disintegrates his body, because the nuclear thing was a little ridiculous. And how does the main character survive Arnold Schwarzenegger should be dead. He was that close to a nuclear blast. So the thing will count down, but the other thing that's going to happen is his ship, which is nearby, will also explode. It's in like a cave. and it's going to explode so that people can't recover the technology. But not everything is destroyed, so there will be able to do sequels where they, we discover that there's a predator and we can, you know, move forward with other films. So that's kind of important to me. The other thing that I really wanted to do is change the environment around. I like the idea of incorporating the favela of Brazil into the storyline because it gives you an urban jungle instead of a literal jungle to kind of do the close quarters combat and the feeling of claustrophobic claustrophobia that you get from the original movie in the jungle. I really want to have those tight corners, which is why I moved my film to the favela. So it's a way to bring Predator to a new audience while still be a great action film, but to tell the story in a different way but use the same characters.
Isn't basically Predator in a city Predator 2?
Yeah, but isn't Fantastic Voyage remade Inner Space with Dennis Quaid? So, I mean...
yeah, Inner Space was directly inspired by Fantastic Voyage, but it was an action comedy. What I'm proposing with mine is that basically between actual technology that we have today and, you, like, basically what I want to create is not just a sci-fi action movie, but also espionage in the vein of Minority Report and Alias, which are with Alias, that's right up J.J. Abrams' wheelhouse. You basically create a ride out of something that most people don't even realize they would want to see. Like, basically, the inside the human body is space, for lack of a better word. It's an adventure in a place that you never even thought about, and at the same time offers unique challenges and also unique visuals. The original movie was made. It was nominated for, and I think won Oscars for its art direction, or it might have even been its special effects. And that was in the 70s. Imagine what you could do now.
1966.
Okay, thank you. Imagine what you could do with it now. And on top of it, you add this element that of espionage to it, and a ticket. It's actually also you add a ticking clock premise to it, where if they don't get out of the body in a certain amount of time, they all die. And so I think that would for an intelligent summer blockbuster. Now, as far as both of your movies are concerned, Badlands is a masterpiece that most of the time I kind of argue with people who say this, but I don't really think you need to remake Badlands. It's Terrence Malick at his best, and that's coming from a guy that's not a big fan of Terrence Malick. Also, I think that particular movie has to be a period piece because in today's world, those characters could not run off and be as isolated as they are in the film in today's world. If this was still in the 50s, I think that works. Way to actually try isolation and this idea that these two characters are off on their own in their own naive delusion about what they're going to do. In the real world today, the cops would find them in a heartbeat. You know, I don't think that, and on top of it, there's no reason to remake Badlands because it's already a wonderful movie. As far as Predator is concerned, no offense, I've seen that movie. It's not just Predator, it's Predator 2, it's every movie with Predator in it and some other movies that have ripoffs of the Predator. Like, you didn't really tell me anything different about, you know, why it is that this group of soldiers fighting this Predator is interesting or unique or brings something new to a premise that we've already seen.
Yeah, but we haven't seen it executed as well since the original film, and that's essentially what we want to try to recapture. In the same way that The Force Awakens reuses much of what took place in A New Hope and even Empire and Return of the Jedi to reestablish the franchise, and I did just compare Predator to Star Wars, I apologize. The point being is it's exactly what The Force Awakens did. They kind of retold the story we are already familiar with, but the purpose of that retelling was to reset the stage and go, look, we want to move forward and tell you new stories in this universe, but in order to do that, we got to get you back to feeling the way you loved about the first one. And that's what I want to do with the Predator movie.
But
I want to remind you what it was about Predator that you loved and get you back to feeling excited about the idea that the Predator could be a movie franchise that we're going to see again. That's why.
But that's just it. The reason Force Awakens works is because it's set in the same universe. It's a sequel.
Hang on one second. What were you saying, Brian?
I just want to let Amy get in so I can hear about Badlands too. Don't worry, I'm going to get you guys.
We're good.
Hi guys.
Hi, Amy. You're still here.
If we were all in the same room, both of you would be in big trouble right now.
Yeah, we would.
So I'm going to start first by, maybe some people don't know what Badlands is. Badlands is based on a true crime spree that took place across the Badlands. And as far as the isolation issue, I think that's why, because I think people are hot on true crime right now. This is one of the, one of the best true crime stories involving two lovers. And it took place across the Badlands. And that's why I want a modern retelling of the film. Because it could be much more exciting. Although the film was a masterpiece, and Malick tried to, blend the ideas of violence and beauty, using visceral scenes and large landscapes, and, they were only hiding out in the woods for not that long, so I don't think isolation was a huge problem here. These two kids essentially traveled so many miles and were so stuck in they were so stuck that they didn't know what to do, that they just kept going on killing and killing and killing and killing. And I think people who have never heard of the, 1974 version of the Badlands, which is a lot of people, unless they're fans of the Criterion Collection, I think they would love to see this film in the modern day. They would love to see this story of crime and passion and violence and beauty brought to the modern day, where we see, essentially like a street kid, doesn't really know that much, doesn't have anything going for him, somehow, Stockholm Syndrome with a 15-year-old girl who's vulnerable. The story itself holds up throughout the years, and even though the original crime happened in the 50s, the story holds up because parents don't still disapprove of who their daughter or son are seeing.
We can hear you.
So basically, like, the story itself holds up, and I think turning it into a modern retelling using, technology that we have today, when they were on this big manhunt to find Kit as a killer, I think it would be a lot more action, it would be more exciting, it would capture the audience, and that's the main reason why I picked Nicholas Winding Refn. He's director of Drive. He can turn a vicious, vicious crime into something beautiful fueled by love. We've seen him do it in Drive with Ryan Gosling, the elevator scene. We cannot argue that. We've seen him do it in Only God Forgives, and we've seen him most recently do it in The Neon Demon. He turned something so horrible into a very visceral, lovely, beautiful experience. And I think that's what Malick was trying to do. He just didn't have the devices at that time to do those things. He also introduced the narrator. And I am going to, I don't want to shit on Tarantino here, but I am going to for a second. Because Tarantino basically took the premise of this film and tried to do it again with True Romance. He did the same thing. He used the same song. But Tarantino doesn't have what it takes to make violence a beautiful thing or visceral or enjoyable to watch. He is more of a shock, shock, shock director, where those scenes in True Romance, the violence was real and it was scary and it was terrifying and it was cover your eyes. You didn't want to see it. Malick wanted people to watch that film scene by scene because it was so beautiful. turning it into something new, using diverse characters. You know, we have an English street kid, you know, from, you know, English street kid, doesn't have any money, you know, is, you know, trying to make it in life, falls in love with Zoe Kravitz. I love Zoe Kravitz. I think she can play the part well. I mean, some of us have seen her in the Allegiant Divergent series, whatever you want to call it, detergent series, needs to be cleansed. awesome. We've seen her play this young, vulnerable, you know, person. I mean, the girl's got to be 15 years old. We got to stick true to the actual factual elements of the true crime. Langley, I'm already confused by your film. Again, I think Jack hit it right on the head. It's like, isn't it that same movie where Martin Short was accidentally in a needle and got, like, shoved into someone? I understand that you're raising the stakes because Helen Mirren has a disease and they need to, you know, have the raise a sense of urgency. But it failed in the 80s as a comedy, and I understand that you're trying to make it more serious, but I think with adding all these new elements, it's just going to come off as a not believable retelling. And as far as Jack's film, I think that people can kind of agree that we've had enough of The Predator. I don't want to see that series or that franchise ruined anymore. In fact, I'm scared to death of the upcoming Predator. I got an Alien vs. Predator figurine in the mail, and I'm sorry, but I threw it in the freaking trash because I'm so sick of that. Again, it's a film that doesn't need to be remade. Like, if anyone wants that, it's in a dumpster somewhere far away. Like, I wanted to take something that was little known.
What were you trying to say, Brian?
No, I'm not going to take it, but I would.
Yeah, like, I just want to take something and update it to modern times that people, the film would work because people love Ren and they love his work.
But you know why people love him? You know why people love him? Because he does original work. I don't see him wanting to remake a masterpiece by another auteur instead of making his own thing. Also, the very fact that you just said that you thought of Innerspace as the actual movie that I'm basing mine off of is the exact reason why this remake is good for right now, because the movie that I want to remake is nothing like Innerspace.
I'm saying your movie was already remade into Innerspace. Your movie already has a remake.
Yeah, how long ago was that?
With the joke.
How long ago was that?
80s, when we were all kids and laughed at it because Martin Short was still funny then.
You're still funny now, Martin Short.
I'm just saying that people, you know, love true crime. And the reason why Ren would make this his own, because he has the ability to do that. No other director has the ability to do that with a film already existing. It's not a remake. This is the difference. It's not a remake. It's a retelling, which is completely different, of the crime spree.
Why, though? Why? Why do we need that?
Because people love true crime. And it's not a question. It's a fact. People love film and TV about true crime spree.
But you're not making it about the actual true crime spree. You're modernizing it. Like, if you're going to retell that story, fine. But you want to update it and modernize it. And at the same time, why would Refn put that – like, why even saddle yourself with trying to remake something that people consider a masterpiece? That would actually handicap him from the beginning. Make your own crime story film based off of something real. You know what I mean? Like, there's no, in my opinion, there's no reason for that. There's nothing that elevates it other than two stars are hot, and that he could make it beautiful because Refn likes to do that with his own work. I would rather see him do something original than to actually taint, if you will, the memory of Badlands.
I don't think it would be tainting the memory of Badlands. I don't think a lot of people have even seen the movie Badlands. That's why I picked that to begin with, because people haven't seen it. And I think
is that a good reason to remake it then? Like,
yes,
if no one,
exactly.
I mean, it's
because people love true crime and they want the real story. And I think modernizing it would make an amazing film. It would be action. It would be love. It would be.
But it's not true. It's not true crime though, because it's not based off of the actual crime that occurred in real life, like Badlands is, because it's modern.
Based off of the actual crime. It's a modern retelling of the actual crime. It's not a remake. It's a modern retelling. So, I don't know, let's add a cell phone here and there. Let's add some technology that we now have. Let's add two up-and-coming fresh face actors that people want to see in movies, and let's pick a genre that people want to see and that's already winning.
All right, guys. Close to wrapping it up here. I'm going to start with Jack and get some final thoughts.
Okay, so the problem with Amy's right now is that I'm hearing more about the original and Terrence Malick and what he did for that film than what really is going to happen in a remake. It sounds like we're just making the same movie again. And I don't really see a reason like to make remake a movie that good if Terrence Malick had done it so well in the original in the first place. With Langley's, again, we do have Interspace, which was, and Martin Short, by the way, is still relevant. He's fantastic as the Cat in the Hat. He teaches my kids on PBS every day. I just think that the Fantastic Voyage, it's going to have to I'm getting an echo and I apologize. I don't know where it's coming through. I think the problem with Fantastic Voyage is it's going to have to devolve into like a CGI fest. Everything's going to be in the body, so there's really probably not going to be any practical effects. I think it's going to look silly. And at the end, it's going to be a special effects movie. I'm not sure how good it's going to be, but when it comes to the Predator movie, the thing I like most about it is how physical it's going to be, how real it will seem, how important the environments are going to be to actually making that movie a success. You know, I want to scare people. I want them to feel tension. I want them to feel being watched. The Predator is an important part of the movie, but it's not like we're going to see the Predator the entire time. So his presence will be looming. And then when we finally do see the final battle at the end, it's not going to be like Arnold and the Predator duking it out. You know, we're taking different story arcs. We're just using the same characters. We're using the same jobs they had before. But other than that, the whole story is original. We're changing up how things work. The Predator is different. The story is different. So there's something completely new for everyone to see the whole way through. Dutch is the only character regulars will even remember from that. And I remember all the names because I'm an idiot. So that's my pitch. I would see Predator.
Okay. Basically listening to you talk about a remake of Predator in the way that you're doing it makes it sound like that terrible Total Recall remake. And it's basically why do it? And like, I haven't heard anything new that adds to it that makes me go, or a twist to it that makes me say, yeah, I want to see that. It's basically just the standard Predator fare. You've even kind of cherry picked Predator 2 where it's in an urban jungle instead of the actual jungle. I don't get why we're rehashing that.
It's not a fictionalized LA though. It's an actual. It's
okay,
a favela setting. So.
Yeah, but as far as like I said with Badlands, like if you're going to say true crime, then it needs to be about the actual crime that occurred. And if you're going to modernize it, then that kind of deflates the idea of it being a true crime, that particular story. Also. Like I said, Badlands, not many people have seen it, but if you're a movie fan, as you get older and you want to appreciate movies in the past, that's one movie that you should watch, and remaking it with sexy hot leads and making Wesson actually come in and do somebody else's work, I really don't want to see that. I'd rather see him make his own crime story like he did with Drive, which was amazing. I don't necessarily want to see that. Now, as far as this whole Interspace comparison, the fact that you think of Interspace is why this is right for a remake. It's because it's something that people have a minor idea of, but at the same time, you get someone like J.J. Abrams, who not only loves practical effects, but is good at not only doing an effects-driven adventure/sci-fi action film, but also is good at espionage and balancing story elements to create tension. He's also good at actually taking you through a ticking clock premise all the way to the end where you're excited by it. It also gives you the opportunity to use special effects, whether they're CGI or not. You would need to use CGI, yes, but just think of the amazing things you could do with retelling that story, a story that was made way off in the 60s when they had no clue about the discoveries in scientific and medical research that we have. It's perfect. It's great as far as a movie now, to make a film now, because you actually add something new to it. You add espionage to it, and you also add seeing something that, you know, people, you get to see inside the human body in a way that we've never looked at it before.
All right, Langley, thank you. And Amy, why don't you wrap up for us?
Okay, just to answer the question as to why, my reason as, you know, why people might want to see this movie, or, you know, why make a retelling of a film that was such a classic in the first place, I think because we're in a different world now, you know, people want to see diversity, they want to see modern retellings of things. If we're going to remake something, let's remake it the right way and, you know, bring it into our time. Again, it's the basis of the general story, of the general crime spree is still, you know, still holds up today. I mean, yeah, we can make a film about any, you know, crime that has happened, you know, in the past 5 years, but the thing is that taking something so classic that people didn't get to see, I think, and turning it into a blockbuster film, which is what I'm trying to do with this, and choosing the only director who has the chops to be able to do something like that, and picking two alluring, you know, actors that have the ability to do something like that. I'm trying to give something to the movie industry, to the entertainment industry, that audiences would, in fact, enjoy, that would hit the box office, that critics would love. I'm not taking away any elements from, you know, Malick's original film. I'm actually adding things that weren't available to filmmakers at that point. I'm adding some, you know... I'm adding things that would enhance that story, but keeping the same baseline, or, you know, based on this story. No one knows the exact things that happened between those two lovers when they were in isolation, or when they were, you know, going around killing people for love, or when they were trying to escape. No one knows exactly what happened. And I think that, you know, as someone who has already tackled the male psyche as far as violence, and now the female psyche as far as violence with The Neon Demon, I think Nicholas Winding Refn would be able to do it. And I think it's a film that will sell, and that's my reason. I think it's different, it's something new for people, and I think it will sell.
And Amy, I got good, it's about to end, I think. So, any cleanup there from the checker pair?
No cleanup, as a lot of this is speculation and wish fulfillment. Predator 4, slotted for 2018, directed by Shane Black, who was in the original Predator as Hawkins. There's a popular fan theory online that Natural Born Killers is a reimagining of Badlands. And Langley was correct. His movie got 2 Oscars, as well as nominated for another 3.
Twitter isn't going too crazy this round. I think they're mostly listening. You have some support and some people also disagreeing with your choices. I do have to give a quick shout out because we found out that Fanfriction Fan and OSP regular Dub, it's his birthday today and he's enjoying the show right now. So happy birthday, Dub.
Happy birthday, Dub.
Happy birthday.
And I have those polls whenever you're ready.
All right, so, you know, good pitch rounds are always hard, guys, so good job on this one. You know, Jack, I feel like you were really fighting an uphill battle with Predator, just because they've had so many chances and they keep trying, and we've seen different settings, and we've seen different, you know, I'm not saying I would love to see your Predator movie. I'm not gonna lie. I'll watch the crap out of that. But it's not, like, their arguments against it were also very good, so I'm gonna push that one off the table and kinda try to prove it a little bit more. You know, I think, Amy, where they got you was that this is a film that, even modernizing it, the core of the film is gonna stay so much the same as far as what you're trying to get out of the story of the couple. And I just don't, that argument of, oh, bringing it, you know, an update for a new audience doesn't hold water for me, because I feel like a classic is a classic. Although it is a good movie, and I'm sure it would be a good remake, I just don't feel like, I don't feel the necessity in the same way. Or, like, the kind of, like, what new they were going to bring to the table with this one. So that's why I think I'm going to go with Langley. I think he nailed, he had a lot of, was interesting as far as a lot of twists and turns. He had a really strong cast. And he hit an important part for me at the very end. We talked, you know, he was talking about the CGI, and he was talking about, you know, the updates. But when he hit the note about the medical updates and how much more we know about the body now, and how interesting I think that could be if done really well in a science fiction movie, I think he had a good director in JJ. You know, he's good with remaking other people's work. He's also good with mixing practical and CGI. He's got, makes good looking movies. So this one goes to Langley.
All right. Cool.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well done, Langley.
And I would love to see both of your films. They both sound awesome.
Yeah, arguably, we could all be good remakes.
Sure, agreed with you.
Yes, actually.
With 63% for Fantastic Voyage, followed by Predator at 38%. Unfortunately, no love for Badlands this time.
Badlands is an awesome film.
It really is good.
Yeah.
It is almost the perfect movie.
Yeah, it's mostly probably due to
just go watch it.
So I apologize to everyone watching at home. Yes, we are going longer than we normally do. It's a new thing for us to try. Bear with us. We'll try to get these last two in quick.
Yeah, I'll try to tighten it up on these last few guys. So round four, let's get started. Ding, ding. The question here is, what is a successful movie that you wish would have bombed? So I'm going to start out with Jack.
Alright guys, so I'm going with Jurassic World, and to cut it right to the chase, Jurassic World should have bombed because it's one of those movies that completely exploits the moviegoer, by making them think that the movie is actually, giving them something that it's not. There is no story in Jurassic World. You're there for the dinosaurs, and it can be entertaining, but it does not hold up under scrutiny. And the problem with this film is that there's gonna be 15 more friggin', Jurassic movies that, they're gonna shove down our throat because Jurassic World was successful. This is a series that did not deserve Jurassic World in the first place. The two sequels to Jurassic Park were abysmal. They are trying to keep this thing alive, and they threw special effects and no story at audiences, and they ate it up. And the problem is, now we're gonna have to go forward and keep seeing this crap fest in new movies, and it's gonna suck. So that's why I picked Jurassic World.
Great. Langley, go ahead and give me your pick.
Okay. When it comes down to, you want a movie that it was successful and we want it to bomb, right? The only reason that I would want to do that is if that movie bombing actually affected something moving forward. So I picked Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. Now here's the thing. I didn't pick Transformers 4 or the third one. I'm picking the second one, and here's why. The first Transformers movie, for most people, is either okay or they like it. And frankly, that's because other people designed that movie, wrote that movie before Michael Bay could get his mitts on it. With the second film, Revenge of the Fallen, basically they barely had a script when they went into making that film, and it was Bay, once again, when a director makes a film, it's successful, and then make a sequel, the director gets empowered now to do whatever the hell that they want, and basically gives you a film that is part of one of the worst franchises in film history. And here's why. If that movie had bombed, see, I think if that movie bombed, you would still be able to have a decent Transformers film based off of what had come before with the first one that actually deals with the Transformers instead of Shia LaBeouf's, you know, and watching female TNA. But we wouldn't have Michael Bay. They would have said, you know what? You have to go. We need somebody else to come in. Maybe, and you have the potential for actually making a Transformers franchise that is good and that people actually want to see. So that's why that's why I picked that movie.
Nope, that, Brian,
I'm done. I'm sorry. There you go.
You still alive, Brian? I think you froze.
he's frozen.
Brian was having some technical difficulties, so he'll be back in a moment. Because this show isn't long enough, everybody. Oh. So we thought maybe, hey, you know, we just have Brian drop right out and then maybe come back, hopefully come back. Here he is. He's alive. See? It's the technology. Brian, you're still there.
With today's technology, I wouldn't want anyone in my body, so I don't know about language.
Give Brian a few more moments, guys. He is having some problems. Thanks for staying with us today. There he is. Brian. We've decided that no one's the winner today, and we're all going home.
Yep.
No, we are home.
We're staying here.
We all win.
Did you get to hear Langley?
I think I got to hear almost everything from Langley. So let's go ahead on to Amy, and then we'll come back. I'm going to try and keep this one fast moving, so I don't want him to have to repeat himself yet. Go ahead, Amy. You're so pretty.
All right, guys, here we go. One word. Minions. Done. Next.
All right, so we're fighting now. You got to give more than one word for Minions. Look, Minions is a kids' movie. It does exactly what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to get kids in the theaters watching goofy little whatever the hell they are. I guess they're just minions running around and having a good time. Minions doesn't destroy the fabric of the space-time continuum in the way that Transformers and Jurassic World does. But the problem with Langley's pick is it is not the worst Transformers movie. The first movie was the right pick here, Langley. You had to stop that movie. You had to stop the Transformers franchise from the source, and that is the first movie. The first movie needed to bomb and bomb abysmally so that we never even had to deal with robot balls or racist ice cream trucks like we did from Revenge of the Fallen. The difference with Jurassic World is, I'll even make this my final thoughts. The problem with Jurassic World is that Jurassic World maintains Hollywood's conditioning over audiences to spend their money because, hey, look, it's dinosaurs. Hey, look, it has Jurassic in it. We're making a sequel to the movie that you love. They didn't mention The Lost World or Jurassic Park 3 when they were pitching that movie. They said, hey, remember when you really loved Jurassic Park? We made another of those movies. You should go see it. The Jurassic World franchise is just a symbol of all the things wrong in movies today. You spend your money on a movie that should be good, but it's not. And they condition you to just keep going to the theater and spending money on these crappy movies. And Jurassic World, for me, is the entire embodiment of that situation.
I feel like Jack just made my point entirely. he just made my point. I have the same exact point with Minions, except there was nothing good that came out of that film. There were a few things in Jurassic World that weren't so bad. Let's go with Chris Pratt here.
Exactly.
Everyone liked him. And if they take the feedback that they've gotten from Jurassic World and they make those changes, much like the DCEU has proven that they are doing, then I think that the future of that franchise has some hope and maybe a little less Bryce Dallas Howard or, you know, her face.
You have Independence Day sequel because Jurassic World is successful. You're welcome. That Independence Day's reviews are horrible. People say it's barely passable as a good movie. All it is shit entertainment value, and you have that movie because Jurassic World was successful.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that Independence Day was a good movie. It was a total shit movie. But you go into a film expecting what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be a fun, entertaining, You know, it's not, who's gonna take time to overanalyze, you know?
I am. You're not gonna put those, kids in those stupid balls and send them wandering around Jurassic World unattended. And then when you have a park emergency, you're not just gonna go over a loud system and say, hey, kids who are too young to be driving this thing in the first place, do me a favor and go back to the station because there's an emergency. I mean, it's ridiculous. There's so many bad things in that. But that movie makes you cheer when a poor innocent girl, a secretary, whose only job is to follow around these kids and they ditch her. The movie wants you to cheer for her death like it was, like she was a villain in that film. Like, there's no reason to, the story in that movie does not hold up in any way. It's a terrible, terrible movie. It's just fooled you into thinking, hey, look, here's Chris Pratt. We have a good movie on our hands.
I'm not saying it's a good movie. I'm not saying it's a perfect movie. I'm just saying there are elements of that movie that are good. There are elements of that film that are good. It's exciting and it's fun.
There's actual things in Jurassic World that you can build on. You can actually build on things in Jurassic World. Amy is correct on that. But the reason why you don't want the first Transformers film to bomb is because Hollywood never learns the right lesson. If the first Transformers movie had bombed, they wouldn't look at it as, oh, we have the wrong director. They would look at it as, you can't make Transformer movies, and then you would have no Transformer movies, period.
I would rather have no Transformers movies, period, than the shit show we have right now in every movie after the Transformers. Like, I would rather not have another Shia LaBeouf movie in a Transformers. I would rather not have whatever this Megatron is. I don't want testicle robots.
Minions? But here's the thing. With Minions, if Minions had bombed...
There's no reason this film needs to exist. It's a 100% total Hollywood cash grab. It's, you know, industry standard.
It's a kids movie.
Oh, people like this. Kids like this. So let's pull it out and let's do it again. And let's make all the money we possibly can. And it's freaking greedy-ass people in Hollywood that make off of these movies that have absolutely no story. There was nothing in there for a child to learn. There was no moral to the story of the Minions. It was just, how much product can we sell from this film? And I think that is the thing in Hollywood that disturbs me the most, is that they are taking away originality and they're taking away everything else. They're thinking that audiences are generally stupid, we don't know any better, and we're just gonna throw out all of our money at a film, and sadly that's what happens.
That is my point, exactly.
Alright, so, can I hear just a little bit more from Langley? I think I've heard Jack and Amy.
Okay. If Minions had bombed, nothing changes. You still would have Minions in the Despicable Me movies, and they would still use those characters wherever they could because, like you said, it's a cash grab. They're lovable few characters that kids like.
They're like little tampons. They're not lovable. There are people who love them, though.
There are people who love them.
How can a kid learn anything or get a story out of a freaking guy who carries around a butt gun? Like, come on. What are we teaching kids these days?
I don't need to teach my kids
as much as you don't like the Minions, there's a crap load of people out there that love them, especially children. And even if that movie had bombed, you would still see Minions everywhere. Except now, they would shoehorn them into more of the other Despicable Me films and try to find some other way of spinning off other characters. So it really wouldn't have done anything. And as far as Jurassic World is concerned, there is enough in Jurassic World that makes it palatable for a decent sequel, including Chris Pratt, the direction, and the fact that it was successful, so they could prove that they could actually go on and make a movie that is decent. Transformers bombing actually would have benefited not only that franchise, but moviegoers everywhere. That's pretty much my closing argument on that.
I know, Brian.
Did everybody feel like they got a chance to talk on this one? I don't want to cut anybody off, but I do want to move it along. We okay with that?
I'm good.
Checker Chair, anything to say?
Everything was pretty clean. I don't think there is any, I think you're good.
Luke Cooley and Joe Davis are saying Twilight for their choice. And picked probably what I would go with, which is Frozen. He said, Frozen, how did he get more attention than Wreck-It Ralph for Big Hero 6? I am still bitter.
I'm with you on Frozen, dude.
I did just rewind.
I'll have to pull it up when you're ready.
I'm sorry, what, Brian?
No, I was just saying, I also just rewatched Big Hero 6. It's awesome. Like, it's great.
It really is.
Okay, so I think what it comes down to here is that Langley hit it the hardest on the legacy of shit that came down from the first movie. You know, you can't, if that one, that you could still be hopeful, but after the second one, we shouldn't, you know, if that one was so terrible and it just fit into Michael Bay and it taught him that he could sell us this and we would be fine. I agree Jurassic World touches on something similar in that vein, but I think it's a little more harmless and done like with a little less like grossness and kind of like pure contempt for the audience. And Minions, I have to agree, although unnecessary and dumb, it's kind of harmless. It's just another kids movie. It's not high-end kids movies. No, you know, nobody's going to argue that. But I think compared to, like, the end result, I'm going to go with Langley and the legacy of shit that is the Transformers series. So, good job,
that's
Langley.
That's
so, Brian.
Legacy of shit.
Brian, why normally would hate the idea of throwing out a question, since both I and Langley have 2 points and Amy is mathematically eliminated, why don't we skip the last question and save it for next time and just move on to the lightning round?
Okay, yeah, we can do that. I'm sorry, Amy.
Real quick, Twitter did agree with you. Langley was overwhelmingly in the lead with a 78% on that
one. Oh, wow.
Good job, Langley.
By Amy's Choice Minions at 22, and no love for Jurassic World. No one's agreeing with you on that one.
Sorry, guys. Dan Merle's not watching. He didn't vote.
All right. So yeah, let's do the Amy, I apologize. I'm not trying to eliminate you from getting a point here, but just in the interest of time, we're 2 hours in.
Yeah. No, it's cool. I'm having a good time. It's cool, guys.
I've just been listening to you guys. I've just let time pour out, and that's my fault. So I'm sorry, Amy.
No, guys, it's totally fine.
Now, excellent fighter, by the way.
Are you gonna handle the timer for me as far as this round goes?
I have timers.
You have a timer? Okay, great. Awesome. So we're going to go with the speed round here. Are we ready?
Let's do it.
We all know the rules of the speed round.
20-10.
Right, you know, if they get the same answer, the first person who said it gets it. They're, you know, 20 seconds, then you get a 10-second rebuttal. Let's go. Speed round one. The best Nicolas Cage performance.
Leaving Las Vegas.
The best Nicolas Cage performance. I'm gonna go with, I'll go with Con Air.
Alright. Langley, you spoke first. Go ahead and hit me up.
Oh, me?
Yep, you're up first, Langley.
Okay. Alrighty. Leaving Las Vegas is his best performance, not just because he won an Oscar for it, but also it demonstrated that Nicolas Cage, even though he can play very strange and weird characters, he's also endearing, and he can also play tragic like nobody's business. It was a heart-wrenching performance, but it was also a performance that elevated him to a new level in his career and actually signified that he was a great actor.
Time.
All right, go ahead, Jack.
Nicolas Cage, as Cameron Poe, does everything he needs to do in that film. He has to carry this movie, which has a kind of a ridiculous premise. He's the one who has to carry this movie to its conclusion, and he plays that role perfectly. Cameron Poe is everything you expect and need out of his film. Not that Las Vegas was a bad film per se, but when it comes to performance, that 20 seconds goes fast. Holy crap.
All right, rebuttal.
Okay. Con Air is basically a gigantic action movie that it really, his performance in that movie is basically Joe Blow, the action hero. There's really no actual depth to the character other than, oh, his wife was attacked.
Now that, he has a lot more character in that film. He shows that he cares about people. He shows that he's in that position because he cares about them in the first place. And because of his performance, he makes all the other actors around him better. He elevates that movie. You care.
All right. Good argument. Shit.
That speed round's a killer, isn't it?
It's unbelievable.
All right. I think this one, I'll go ahead and pitch it out. Amy, what do you think? I'll take a little poll here. Amy, you got an opinion?
I love Con Air, so I'm going to go check.
Base it on the arguments.
Okay, Andy. No, I'm kidding. I'm still
going to
go Jack.
Take your share. You guys want to weigh in?
Unfortunately, I think I just... Not unfortunately. It's fortunate for whoever. Unfortunately for Jack, maybe. More from Langley. I did like that Jack got one of the characters' name in there, but unfortunately, I heard a lot more from Langley, so I'm going to have to give it to Langley. It's just because Jack didn't realize how long the speed round was. Happens to the best of us.
Yeah, it does.
I love Con Air too, but it's not very much because of Nick Cage's performance. I do think he's a little one note in that. He's a little bland. So I have to agree with Langley. I think he made some good points. The range, he elevated Cage, his career. So I'm gonna give the first speed round to Langley.
Put the bunny back in the box.
What about when Nick Cage does this?
I'm not imitating that. It won't look as good.
All right. Good job, Langley.
Good job, Langley. Let's keep this trucking right along. Speed round question number two. What is the best comedy sequel?
Ghostbusters 2. Amy's laughing because she's so excited how right I am.
Best comedy sequel.
Langley there?
Yep, I'm here, sorry.
He's thinking about it.
Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Beverly Hills Cop 2? Alright, Jack, I heard you first. Whenever you're ready.
Ghostbusters 2 gets Ernie Hudson in the mix, first of all, so now it's all four of them. It takes more of what you loved about the first movie and gives it to you. They're back in New York. The comedy is still there. It's funny and consistent throughout. All of the characters are on point. You still get Rick Moranis and Dana Barrett, Sigourney Weaver. They're all hitting on all cylinders. The movie's fun.
Alright. Just tell me when I need to go.
Oh, whenever you're ready, Langley. I'm ready for you. Sorry.
Okay. Beverly Hills Cop 2, just like he said, also accentuates what you got from the first one and elevated the character of Axel Foley. It's bigger, it's better, and it becomes an even bigger action movie, and at the same time being hilariously funny. Ghostbusters 2 is regarded by a lot as a very mediocre sequel.
While Beverly Hills Cop 2 had actual, or excuse me, when Beverly Hills Cop 1 had actual stakes, Beverly Hills Cop 2 just took all that and threw it away and made it a movie about comedy, about being funny, and it's all the same jokes as in the first movie. Whereas,
like you just said, it's a movie that is funny, as opposed to Ghostbusters 2 is basically a pale imitation of the first with a plot that not many people can even understand and describe what's happening in it.
Time.
And,
woo! All right, I'm going to need a little help here. Amy, what do you think?
I hate to say it, but I was afraid of this mystery fighter today, and I think with a good reason, because he just made a very good point. He basically said that Lethal Weapon 2 took everything else out of it and just left comedy. Does it make it the best comedy sequel? Yeah, it's just a comedy. It kind of left everything else behind. So I'm going to go with Jack on this one.
You mean Beverly Hills Cop?
Correct?
Yeah, you mean Beverly Hills Cop.
Okay. I'm not consumed.
It's nothing against Jack. Jack got out a bunch of names and stuff like that, but when it came down to the, like, movies versus movies, like, I heard from Jack that, like, yeah, your movie was a comedy, and the question is, comedy. Like, what's the best comedy sequel? And I thought Langley's comeback to that was great. So I'm going Langley. I'm going Langley.
Hey, thanks for all the help, guys.
I know.
You had some similar, similar points as far as both give us more of the same from the first. Both have great returning cast, but I think that Langley hit it up where I think Beverly Hills Cop is the more well-regarded sequel. Although I stand by Ghostbusters 2,
popped in my head. It just was there all of a sudden, and then I said it. I don't even know what I was thinking.
Turn you guys out with Game World 2. Come on.
Oh, God, yes.
It popped in my head, and I couldn't undo it.
So I'm going to go with Langley. Langley wins round two in the speed round. He's running good away job. With it.
I got to get every one of these.
Okay, so, yes, we're in a position where Jack has got to come through. Now, I have a really, what I hope is an interesting segment and also a shameless plug for my own show, The DVD Bunker. Our third speed round question is going to be something I'm going to call the Bunker Buster. I'm going to show you guys two movies. I want you to pitch which one should be an episode of the DVD Bunker and why. Whoever speaks up first gets that movie. Same rules as the the cheap picks or whatever they call it on that other name show that we don't name.
Bargain Bin?
Bargain Bin. Yeah. Bargain Bin, yeah. So I'm going to hold these. I'm going to try and give you time so you can see them and everything. You guys can both see me, right? You see my camera?
Nope.
Here we go. Bunker Buster. Two picks.
I can't see it.
You see it now?
Yeah, you have to talk.
Oh, Blues Brothers 2000 and Nothing But Trouble.
Blues Brothers. Your two Blues Brothers.
Nothing.
All right.
Nothing,
Jack takes
Nothing But Trouble.
Wagley, you get Nothing But Trouble. Do Dan Aykroyd classic.
Hello.
Jack, I'm going to ask you to go first. Remember that the element here is to pitch me why it would make a good episode of The Bunker. Whenever you're ready.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking.
No, take your time. I just want to let you know I'm ready when you are.
The Blues Brothers is one of those films that you need to remind yourself why John Belushi was the great comedic actor that he was, and that's the movie that will do it. Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi together are a tour de force. They are hilarious. They are funny, which is the same word. The music in that movie is spectacular, and you need to remind yourself of all the greatness that is the Blues Brothers.
Time.
I was close.
Okay. Wasn't that Blues Brothers 2000?
Yeah, that was the Blues Brothers 2000.
Okay, all right. Nothing But Trouble is an abysmal film that is just mind-numbingly bad, but at the same time, you can laugh at it. One of the cool things that you can discuss on your show is the fact that it's one of the first films that has Tupac Shakur in the film, along with the rest of the guys from Digital Underground. And on top of it, the movie that he just chose was Blues Brothers, not Blues Brothers.
Jack, you ready with a rebuttal?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it because I'm going to need one. Look, ultimately you need to see the interaction between John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. Their comedic talent together, their timing, their poise, that is what funny is all about. They are masters of comedy, and watching them work is an important thing.
Yeah, watching those two together is great in Blues Brothers, but the movie is Blues Brothers 2000, which doesn't have A. Belushi in it and has John Goodman. And it's a dismal failure of a sequel.
Wait, the movie was 2000, not the original Blues Brothers? I couldn't see the 2000, and now I realize what I was doing wrong. So I thought I was arguing for the original Blues Brothers the whole time.
Yeah, not so. Well,
I couldn't see it, so I what are you going to do?
No, I mean, this is a new segment. We were just trying something out. I hate to punish you.
Because I hate to cancel your show.
Oh, geez.
That would never happen.
Your show are really going to be upset that it's not on anymore.
Nah, I have to get Langley on that, too. Well, I joke for Langley. I got the wrong movie, so.
I have an extra question just in case. So why don't we go ahead and let that one go? The bunker is busted. I am going to do one of those movies, though. It's going to happen. So maybe both. But let's go ahead and we'll scratch that round. We'll give it a pass. If we need to go to my last question, I have a last speed round question if we need it, okay?
All right.
I'm planning ahead. So you're right about Blues Brothers being great, by the way.
Yes, fantastic movie.
All right. So speed round four, Hollywood's best Martin.
Martin?
Martin.
We'll take Sheen. First.
You said Hollywood's best Martin.
Martin, yes. And I'll take first or last name.
Oh, really? Oh, well, I guess I said one already. But if you didn't write it down, I'll think of another one.
I did write it down.
Yeah, that's all right. I'll take my pick. Tell you what, man, the speed round's a bitch. The lightning round, in this case, just is a bit of a bitch.
Welcome to my nightmare, Jack.
Hell yeah, man, you're not kidding.
Langley, you still there?
Yep. Martin Campbell.
Oh, thank you for giving me a shot, Langley.
All right, Jack, I'll let you go first.
Martin Sheen is arguably one of the best Sheens to ever produce, come from that gene pool. Apocalypse Now is a brilliant film, one of the best films ever, and he's been in a ton of them. He is also the father of Emilio Estevez and Charlie Sheen, which actually should not be discounted because those are also two great actors. But as Sheens go, he is the brightest. Because he's Sheen, bright, get it?
Yeah, that was a good
idea.
All right, Martin Campbell. I don't know if you know, but Martin Campbell is a great director. He gave us both GoldenEye and he gave us Casino Royale, two of the best Bond films ever. People have been trying to ape his particular action style forever. He actually knows James Bond inside and out. And Martin Sheen should not get credit for giving us Charlie Sheen.
Hi.
He is a waste.
But we should give him credit for Apocalypse Now. Easily one of the best performances in a film ever. He deserved the Oscar he won. It's a brilliant performance, and that is the quality that Martin Sheen brings to every movie.
Martin Campbell, as a director, in my opinion, actually gave us more than Martin Sheen as far as his career. He's been in a bunch of duds, like The Amazing Spider-Man 2, whereas Martin Campbell is a brilliant...
I need, like, one more round to continuously destroy Martin. You're Martin.
No, you don't get an extra round just for cheating. Okay, we're going to go ahead. Amy, what did you think?
Martin Sheen, for sure.
Is our checker chair still there? Did they bounce out?
My favorite Sheen is Emilio Estevez. I'm going to give it to Jack because I felt Jack's argument was stronger. I just wish he said that Martin directed Green Lantern because he did.
Yep, that's what I was waiting for.
I meant to come back. That's why I was like, can I have a few extra 10 seconds to put him down?
Oh, all right. Well, there you go.
I forgot to fight him a little bit more, too.
Yeah, I think we're in agreement this round. I think Jack takes it with Martin Sheen. Good job, guys. I'm going to try and just move along here.
Martin Scorsese, by the way. I can't believe I didn't pick I can't believe you didn't pick Martin Scorsese.
Martin Freeman.
You know what came to my mind was Martin Mull and Martin Lawrence.
Oh my God, that would have been amazing to play Martin Lawrence versus Martin Sheen. All right, anyway, we got to keep moving. I'll shut up.
Okay, lightning round number 5. What is the best book-to-movie adaptation?
Gone Girl.
Jaws.
All right, Langley, I heard you first. Let's hear it.
Okay. Gone Girl is a superb filmmaking. The actual screenplay was written by the actual author of the book, but she's so good that she actually recognized that books and movies are two separate things. It also gave us, she gave us that wonderful creepy vibe in a movie with such a twist in it that it still haunts you to this day.
Time.
Lots of movies have great twists, but the thing you didn't know about Jaws was that it was a book, because a lot of people don't. The adaptation to film of that book, it's one of the few times you can actually say that a movie may actually be better than the book for capturing all of the great visuals and terror that come with a giant shark in the ocean that you cannot stop. It's an amazing adaptation of a book.
As far as adaptations go, the idea is to take the book and translate it. There are people, including Spielberg himself, who admit that the movie is pretty much nothing like the book by Peter Benchley.
Time.
Also,
the problem with Gone Girl is Gone Girl doesn't really have much of a twist, regardless of how it's adapted from the book. It's a very predictable movie and doesn't actually surprise as much as you think. Jaws is exciting and gets your adrenaline pumping throughout, and it
Time.
Makes you want to see what the book
Time.
Is about.
Time.
All right, just for the sake of time, I'm not going to take any votes on this one. I think I have this one, and I think it comes down to Langley really nailed you with Spielberg acknowledging that closely. It's not as, and I think that although Jaws is a great movie, I don't think the adaptation is good. I think Fincher is a master at adapting things. I think it's so hard to take anything away from him, and it was beautifully directed, and the screenplay being by the author, those are just great moments. So, hey, I think Langley's our big winner today.
Yay!
Loved it.
I have redemption.
Good
well
for
done,
you. Well played, my man. Well played, everyone.
Thank you.
To all everybody who watched all the way through, I'm sorry. I know this is my first time judging. I'm doing my best here.
This is officially the longest episode we've ever had. Thank you.
Yeah.
So if you're still watching live, we appreciate it.
Because I got that stand.
Woo. You want to close us out, Brian? You want me to do it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, let me hit us up. Everybody here, great fighters, Amy Awesome. Find her on Twitter, @AmyAwesome. You know what? Give your own Twitter plugs because, yeah, I know I've seen them, but I can't remember them all. So please, plug yourself for Twitter.
You can reach me at Langley M. Neely pretty much everywhere, in Twitter, Facebook, just my name. So,
Amy, tell us where to find you.
Oh, hey guys, I'm still here. You can find me on Twitter @AmyAwesome. That's with a zero. And you can also read my work on ScreenJunkies.com. Basically, I've written anything that has my face plastered onto it. So just click on that news tab and check some things out. Maybe you'll like it. Maybe you won't. As you saw today, I'm pretty highly opinionated. Very
brilliant.
Let's say I kind of held back a lot today, just for my fellow opponents.
We love you, Amy. Come on now. Hey, Brian, tell us a little about the DVD bunker.
Yeah, you guys can find me here bi-weekly, so far at the DVD bunker. Just dropped a new episode about the 90s John Ritter classic Stay Tuned. Suggestion from Kimber over there. You can find me at Hercules, #DVDBunker if you want to talk about that, #FanFriction if you want to talk about how I did here or how I'm the champ. Any of those things are up for debate. Thanks for watching.
Awesome. Tom and Kimber.
You can catch us on Twitter at @SJPlusJunkie and @IAmTomRiddler. We also do a show on Monday nights called Odd Shaped Panel for this channel, and that's on Blab at 9 p.m. Tomorrow we're going to be specializing on directors of all kinds. I just posted the questions right before we started this episode here, so go ahead and check those out on my page. And if you can, join us tomorrow. We'd love to talk to you.
Yeah, tweet us at Odd Shaped Panel. We also just put up a Facebook. We're literally about to run out the door to go tape a little Game of Thrones party down in New Jersey, and we'll maybe throw it up on here if it's any good after I edit it. We'll see. But
awesome. guys, thank you all for coming today. You can find me here hosting Fan Friction right here on the Tuff channel. If you want to tweet at me, you can do it at JRSPipBoy2008. All of our information is in the description below. And as always, we do this as a labor of love to the Screen Junkies. This is we're inspired by movie fights. That's what brought Fan Friction into being. If you're not familiar with the Screen Junkies, we'd love for you to check them out. Their information is in the description. You can find Amy Austin's work there, along with a bunch of great shows on Screen Junkies Plus. So please check them out. They're fantastic. And thank you to everyone for coming for this episode. We know it was long. We appreciate you hanging out, and we will see you all next time. Have a good one, everybody.
Bye.